supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight.
Officers and their families, inmates and their families, and the public should hold us accountable to address the recommendations identified to correct bad practices and lack of communication and to start the multi-year effort to change the culture here at our state's largest maximum security prison.
Almost a year and a half after a fatal prison riot at the James T. Vaughn Correctional Center in Smyrna, Delaware, officials today released a report updating progress in responding to dozens of recommendations put forth in an independent review. Joining me with details is WHYY's Mark Eichmann. Mark, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks so much, Dave. Good to be with you.
We'll get to the recommendations, but review what took place in February of 2017.
That was when inmates took over control of the prison, Building C, at the James Vaughn Correctional Center in Smyrna, the state's biggest prison. Inmates took control, took several corrections officers and a counselor hostage, and held them hostage for the better part of 20 hours before it was all over. One correctional officer was killed by the inmates before prison officials, state police, and others finally regained control of the prison.
This was a very sad day across the state of Delaware. After a torturous 15-hour ordeal that went through the night, we learned of Sergeant Floyd's demise.
It's been widely reported that, in part, prison administrators dismissed several warnings, including ones that came forth that day.
Yeah, and the most tragic thing about this possibly is the fact that one of the persons who was giving the warning that certain inmates probably should not have been put in the same cell block or even in the same cells together, that warning came from Sergeant Floyd, who was killed by the inmates. And that warning from Floyd came just a few days before the hostage situation that ended in his death.
Officer Floyd did recognize that there were individuals that he thought should be moved. And as far as we can determine, his requests were not acted upon. Had it been acted upon, or had he been moved from that building, and we use the word may. We can't make the definite conclusion, but his death may have been avoided.
It's possible we wouldn't be here talking about it, and he would still be alive. So a real tragic detail in what was allowed to happen.
Governor Carney ordered the independent review.
We also have to investigate what happened here, determine the facts, to make sure that it never happens again.
What were some of the factors that led to administrators dismissing the warnings?
Well, there was a lot of poor communication between administration and the correctional officers and between correctional officers to inmates. The report pointed out systematic and operational dysfunction and a lack of clear and consistent leadership as one of the problems that led to this and one of the reasons those warnings were not heeded.
So, to what extent has that been remedied?
Well, according to the report that came out today, it has been remedied to a great extent. They've improved communication system-wide across prisons, and it's not just at Vaughn. These recommendations go across the prison system and the Delaware Department of Correction, that they've improved the way they communicate administration to guard, to correctional officer, also correctional officer to inmate in hopes that that will not happen again.
One of the lingering problems pertains to overtime, though. Has that been changed?
And that's really the one issue that sticks out in this report that came out today as an area that still is in dire need of being addressed. Over-dependence on overtime was highlighted in an auditor's report that came out last year that said the Department of Correction spends $800,000 on overtime every 2 weeks. That translates to about $57,000 every day just in overtime.
Above and beyond the financial considerations that you cited, what are some other problems associated with excessive overtime?
Well, there's burnout. It's obviously a very difficult job to work behind bars with some very bad people who are imprisoned. These correctional officers can be frozen in place if there's a vacancy in the next shift that they have to stay there. It's not like they can just walk out of the prison and say, we'll get it in 8 hours when the next person comes in. You know, they have to stay there. And being stuck in that position from the union that I've talked to, the Correctional Officers Union, is a very frustrating and very sort of demoralizing thing, to be stuck in this mandatory overtime. And that has, according to the report that came out last year, that contributed to the way correctional officers treated inmates, and it didn't help anything as far as the relationship between officer and inmate goes, that the men and women have been stuck in their position, frozen in overtime, because they're such short staff.
Mark, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed on this issue.
My pleasure, Dave.
WHYY's Mark Eichmann on Newsworks Tonight. A new residential facility in North Philadelphia is giving homeless patients a place to heal after they're discharged from the hospital. As WHYY's Aaron Moselle reports, Serenity Court is the first and only medical respite of its kind in the city.
Living on the street can be really rough on your body, especially your skin. After spending hours in the bitter cold this winter, Ronald Lane says he found himself suffering from frostbite again.
My feet, my ankles, my legs and knees had froze over the temperatures. But when the temperatures got warmer, my skin started to crack and split and developed a maggot situation for me that was very bad.
So bad, he landed in the hospital. He needed surgery to remove all that dead tissue. He's been staying at Serenity Court since being discharged in early June.
I'm just happy to be here, to be truthful, because if she didn't contact or the hospital didn't contact them or whatever the case may be, I don't think I will be around.
Every day, nurses wrap Lane's legs and feet in fresh gauze and give him medications prescribed to aid his recovery. They're also there if something goes wrong, like a couple weeks ago when he came down with pneumonia. Gina Gentile is nurse manager at Serenity Court, which is operated by the nonprofit Public Health Management Corporation. She says one of the main goals of the facility is to cut down on the number of homeless people returning to the emergency room because they couldn't properly take care of themselves after being released the first time.
Imagine having your appendix removed and then told by the hospital that you're being discharged, and your discharge is on a corner.
Serenity Court has a total of 20 beds for homeless men and women, with patients staying an average of 10 to 14 days. Room and board is covered through contracts with area hospitals. Medicaid covers the clinical services. After they've healed, the hope is that patients will be able to transition to permanent supportive housing, but there's no guarantee that will happen, which means it's possible that someone like Ronald Lane could find themselves on the streets again, back on their feet physically, but not financially. Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
This disclosure, Public Health Management Corporation supports WHYY. Casino companies in Pennsylvania are placing their bets this week, and the state is cashing in. Let's set the odds with Penn Live reporter Charlie Thompson. Charlie, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Sure, glad to be here.
So specifically, casinos are ponying up to the State Gaming Control Board as Pennsylvania prepares to become the fourth state, joining New Jersey, Delaware, and Nevada in offering online wagering. And yesterday was apparently the last day for casinos to take advantage of a certificate early bird special. Explain.
The casino companies had until Monday to file for a certificate to operate all types of online gaming that's now permitted by our law, that being online slots games, online poker, and other types of casino table games, be it blackjack or roulette or whatever, that are simulated for internet play. Through yesterday, the casino operators in Pennsylvania could apply for a license, and all of the above kind of license, for $10 million. With that door closed now, a casino company can still opt for online poker only or online slots only at a price of $4 million apiece. But yesterday essentially brought to a close the period where I think the best way to think of it is people could get the broadest possible license for the lowest possible cost.
So of the 13 current casino companies with licenses in the state, how many took advantage of the early bird special?
9 operators, so there should be plenty of choice out there for somebody that wants to bet online.
Now, is sports wagering included?
No. Sports wagering is authorized by law in Pennsylvania now. However, it is in a regulatory startup phase. So unlike New Jersey or Delaware, where people can actually go to casinos and place a bet now, we're not up and running in Pennsylvania yet. That is on a separate track here. I guess the race is on to try to get it up and running by football season, which is sort of the king of the gambling year. It's a little murky as to whether they'll have everything up and running on sports betting here in Pennsylvania by the start of the football season. I would expect that it would be operational before the Super Bowl rolls around.
And in looking to Delaware, New Jersey, and Nevada as precedents, is it a zero-sum game, meaning does internet wagering take away from physically coming into a casino, or does this add to the coffers?
Most casino analysts and gaming industry analysts will tell you that the ability to place a bet from a smartphone or from a tablet is enabling them to capture a different audience than goes in and stands at a blackjack table or stands before a slot machine. Now, that tends to be an older audience. People who play online games tend to be a younger audience. And the casinos are happy to meet that new audience where they are. And then hopefully the long-term play is that they convert them into people who will also make visits to their land-based properties.
What are the rules and regulations for those hoping to place their bets? Do you, for example, have to be a Pennsylvania resident to play in Pennsylvania?
There will be systems put in place that will allow you to place a bet with a Pennsylvania operator as long as you're in the state of Pennsylvania. If you're in New Jersey or if you're in Maryland or Ohio or New York, theoretically your bet's going to be blocked. And I've seen demonstrations of this technology, and it's really kind of spectacular how they can kind of get the geographic location of bettors down. There are also age confirmation and identification confirmation hurdles that any bettor would have to go through.
Charlie, what's the timeline going forward?
This timeline is probably months away before things actually get launched. The casino companies generally don't offer their online gaming platforms themselves. They generally do it through a third-party provider. So those third-party providers are being licensed by the state as we speak. The state has to review the petitions they received yesterday. They have 90 days to grant these formal approvals. I think we'll see online gaming rolled out in Pennsylvania certainly before the end of the year, probably this fall.
Well, thank you for explaining this to us on Newsworks Tonight.
Sure, thank you.
Penn Live reporter Charlie Thompson. Last weekend saw the final storming of the Bastille in Philadelphia's Fairmount neighborhood. After 24 years of staging a Bastille Day celebration at the walls of Eastern State Penitentiary, the historic prison has thrown in the towel. It's now up to the neighborhood businesses to create something else that can draw crowds during the slow summer months. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports it's the challenge for businesses all over the city.
For the poet T.S. Eliot, April was the cruelest month, but for Philadelphia restaurants, it's August.
August is the worst of the worst.
Terry McNally is co-owner of London Grill. A quarter century ago, she started a goofy Bastille Day celebration as a drunken lark, and it grew into an annual street festival that attracted as many as 10,000 people. She said it was originally just supposed to keep customers from going down the shore in the summer.
They don't just go to the shore. If they're wealthy, they're not going to South Jersey. They're going to Maine or Europe or, they're leaving. But we got, for Bastille Day, we got everybody to stick around.
Every summer, business owners across Philadelphia dream up gimmicks to keep locals from fleeing the city. In South Philadelphia, East Passyunk Avenue has been called a renaissance of new Philadelphia restaurants, but even that is powerless against the summer doldrums, says Pam Zenzola of the East Passyunk Avenue Business Improvement District.
There's a lot more parking. There's a lot more parking during the day. Actually, I'm looking out the window now and there's no parking. But yes, it does absolutely get slower, especially when July 4th is in the middle of the week. It's amazing how slow it was this last week.
To counter that, on July 29th, a stretch of East Passyunk Avenue will shut down to traffic for the 13th annual car show. About 200 classic cars, all dolled up, will park along the road, and about 10,000 people will come to ogle. Zenzola says a few years ago, the event almost did not happen because of a threat of rain, and that is when she learned people actually come from the shore to the city to see these cars.
I mean, they were driving up from Cape May. They were coming from the Poconos. They were, the phone calls are, is it on? Is it on? Even though we put it on social media and posted everywhere, they were still calling here. And North Jersey, Delaware, Maryland. I was surprised. I had no idea.
These street festivals often do more than ring cash registers. They can be an opportunity to build community support. 10 years ago, a bunch of bars and restaurants in Northern Liberties closed down 2nd Street to traffic to have bands play outside and to sell beer. Now, the 2nd Street Festival, this year on August 5th, attracts about 35,000 people strolling from Spring Garden to Girard Avenue, says co-founder William Reed.
It was partly just, you know, drum up some business. That was part of it. But it also, we were trying to take the street back from cars, like stop from feeling like a small highway at times. Cars just can just dominate a neighborhood, and we're trying to kind of claw some of that back, at least for a day.
Reed is the owner of Standard Tap in Northern Liberties and used the 2nd Street Festival as a catalyst to form a Neighborhood Business Improvement District, or a BID. Proceeds from that event paid for studies and consultants that helped push the BID through City Council, which approved it a few weeks ago. But the proliferation of street festivals can also take a toll on businesses. McNally of London Grill and the Bastille Day Celebration points out that many pop-up beer gardens that seem to sprout everywhere in Philadelphia when it gets hot are also attempts to keep people in the city during the summer, often at the peril of more permanent businesses.
They hurt. Everything hurts. All the competition hurts. And it's just like Philly's the wild, wild west, just letting everybody do whatever the hell they want all the time. And a lot of the restaurants are suffering.
As for Bastille Day, McNally vows to keep it going even without the support of Eastern State Penitentiary. She wants to tip the toque to the French on their special day. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Major League Baseball's 2018 season hits its unofficial midway point, the All-Star break. And at this juncture, the Phillies occupy first place in the National League East. The young team was not predicted to be this good. And as WHYY's Avi Wolfman Arendt reports, fan enthusiasm is still catching up to the results on the field.
26,740. That's how many people are going to your average Phillies game this year, which is up about 800 fans from last year. Now, that doesn't seem like a huge jump for a last-place team that's suddenly charged into first place.
The Phillies would be lying to you if they told you they weren't a little underwhelmed by the turnout this season.
David Murphy writes a sports column for the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News and says the lukewarm fan response has spurred a lot of debate in the press box. Are people still in wait-and-see mode about this young team, or is this part of a bigger problem?
It's not just the Phillies. I think this is a trend throughout baseball.
Matt Gelb is the Phillies beat writer for The Athletic.
Attendance throughout baseball is way down.
Gelb and Murphy also point out that there's a natural lag time between when a team turns a corner and when fans start to take notice. That happened the last time the Phillies emerged as a contender in 2007 and 2008.
The Philadelphia Phillies are 2008 World Champions of Baseball!
Murphy says fan interest will spike if these Phillies stay in the playoff race, and the team's fate may hinge on the types of trades that they make in the next couple of weeks.
They're going to do something. It's just a matter of how big.
And the same could be said for those pesky attendance numbers. Avi Wolfman Arendt, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.